From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Clint Eastwood about directing his new movie, Letters from Iwo Jima. It tells the story of the World War II battle on the Japanese island from the point of view of the Japanese who fought there. The story is the flip side of Eastwood's recent film Flags of Our Fathers, which described the battle from the American perspective and told the story behind the famous photo of five Marines planting the American flag there. About 20,000 Japanese soldiers and 7,000 American soldiers died in the 36-day battle. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new 12-DVD set of Rodgers and Hammerstein musicals. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Clint Eastwood, has directed two films about one of the bloodiest battles of World War II, the Battle of Iwo Jima. The first film, Flags of Our Fathers, showed the battle from the American point of view and told the story behind the famous Pulitzer Prize-winning photo of five Marines planting the flag there. Eastwood's new film, Letters from Iwo Jima, describes the battle from the perspective of Japanese soldiers. The Japanese soldiers in Iwo Jima were told to expect to die there, and most of them did. About 20,000 of the 22,000 Japanese troops on the island were killed in the battle. About 7,000 Americans died there. The Japanese general who was chosen to command the battle, Tadamichi Kurabayashi, developed a strategy of digging underground caves through the island, interconnected by about 16 miles of tunnels, so that when the Americans invaded, they were attacked by soldiers who remained hidden from view. But the Japanese were outnumbered by the more than 70,000 Marines who came in over 800 ships. The battle lasted 36 days. Letters from Iwo Jima is on many film critics' 10 best lists, including our critic David Edelstein, who also included Eastwood's Flags of Our Fathers. Clint Eastwood, welcome back to Fresh Air, and congratulations on your new film. Did you know that you wanted to make two films, one from the Japanese and one from the American point of view on Iwo Jima? Or was the second film, the one that was just released, did that occur to you somewhere during the process of working on the first?
It occurred during the process. I was, as we were preparing to do Flags of Our Fathers, it occurred to me that the general who was the defender of the island was considered by American generals to be quite clever, and so I just started getting curious about as to what he was like, and so I asked a friend in Japan to send any books that were on him. There were no books in English, but there was a small book about letters that he had written home when he was an envoy in the United States and in Canada in the late 20s and early 30s, and so he had written home and drawn little pictures for his daughter and his son to show him what it was like where he was. And so I thought, this is an interesting person, not only the humanity that he had as a father towards his kids, but also the fact that he was learning English and learning a lot about our culture at that particular time.
Is the movie based on letters that he actually wrote during the Battle of Iwo Jima?
Yes. The book actually takes it up through letters that he later wrote from Iwo Jima right up till he wasn't heard from anymore. But it so then I went through, and we've got many articles from magazines and things, though it is not taught, history of this battle is not taught in Japan. There were some articles speculating on some of the people who were on the island at that time, and everything from Olympic champions to regular, the working men who were sent over there with the instructions that don't plan on returning.
Is it not taught in Japan because the battle was such a defeat for the country?
I think so. I think after the war, they didn't teach much about any of the final days of it. They a little bit more on Okinawa because there was a lot of civilian casualties there. But on Iwo, which was the first Japanese soil that the Marines invaded when they were taking, because throughout the South Pacific, they were retaking islands that had already been taken and controlled by Japan, and now this was the first Japanese soil, so it became a very important battle for them to defend. They were trying to discourage the Americans from invading the mainland of Japan.
You know, as an American watching the movie, you're in a very almost awkward situation. Usually in a war film, the film is told from your country's point of view, you know, if it's an American movie, and of course you're rooting for the soldiers, and you're rooting for them to, you know, vanquish the other side. But in this film, you become very fond of, you know, some of the soldiers and leaders in it, not all of them, but some of them. And you don't want them to die, and at the same time, you don't want them to kill the Americans who they're fighting. So you can't have a conventional war film response to this movie.
No, absolutely. It's you're not. It doesn't isn't meant to take their side of the story. It's just meant to show that they were in a very tough position by being defenders of a cause that hadn't been working. The Japanese at that time were under the influence of a military complex that was very aggressive, had been very aggressive throughout the world, and now they were on the final defense. And so this is just to show their reaction and what their people like. But when it boils down to is when mothers are losing their sons, the mothers, whether they're Japanese or American or whatever nationality, the reaction is always has the same pathos.
Now, you mentioned that the letters from Iwo Jima is loosely based on real letters from Lieutenant General who led the Japanese end of the battle, and he's played in the movie by Ken Watanabe. Did you read those letters yourself?
Yeah, I read the ones that were all in the books and everything we could find, and the family furnished us with quite a bit of information. All those letters that Ken Watanabe reads back, most of the information in there is exactly as it was.
What struck you most about those letters?
Well, the poignancy of a father writing to his children and to his wife about being off at war and about doing this job and wishing he could be with them and wishing he had fixed the kitchen door before leaving and apologizing for not attending to as many things. Talking to his kids about their use of grammar in their letters back, and it was just kind of it was the same as any father in any society.
It was really interesting to watch how the Japanese military is portrayed in the film. You know, I think most Americans know that there were, you know, so-called kamikaze fighters during World War II who flew planes right into their target, and the pilots basically committed suicide in the attack. And you portray the kind of emphasis on honor and that killing yourself would be better than surrendering and better, in some instances, than retreating as far as the Japanese military higher-ups were concerned. There's a scene in the movie, and I hope you don't feel I'm giving too much away here, but there's a scene in the movie where several of the Japanese soldiers, knowing that they've lost their end of the battle, consecutively blow themselves up with hand grenades that they've kept. And it's just a really kind of shocking and just like disturbing scene to watch them kill themselves like this. Can you talk a little bit, not only about shooting it, but what you had read or heard about this kind of thing happening?
Well, it was quite common in that the philosophy at that particular time and committing seppuku, as they call it, or harikiri, but if you read books, there's a book out called the Kamikaze Diaries. That's in English, and it's letters back from these young students who were conscripted into flying, and they picked these young college students because they could figure they'd give them a cram course in flying where they were only going to fly one way. So it was, but most of the letters are quite pathetic because you see there, they're writing back and telling their mothers that they really don't want to be doing this and they really don't want to die, and they couldn't resist. The chain of command throughout the Japanese military was very, very strict and very rough, and if you didn't go along with it, you were in deep trouble.
Could you talk a little bit about shooting that scene in which several of the Japanese soldiers blow themselves up with hand grenades?
Yeah, well, that actually happened, and we portrayed that the results of that in Flags of Our Fathers. But in the Mount Suribachi, there was a a point where the Japanese that were stationed in that section of the island felt that there was no hope, and so they just started blowing themselves up, and that's very, very difficult for us to understand in the from an American philosophy, but they actually did that, and that in the book Flags of Our Fathers, they account for that sequence. They chronicle that sequence, and it's kind of an amazing thing. And so on the other one, we show them leading up to it and how it came about by a misunderstanding, actually, because General Kuribayashi didn't believe in all that. The interesting thing that made me want to tell the story about him was that he didn't really believe in suicide attacks and Benzai attacks and all these things that were very common for the Japanese soldiers at that time. He believed that being a dead soldier was not being effective at all. So he was a very practical guy, and he came up with all the ideas of tunneling through the island and connecting tunnels that would make a person be able to get away and fight another day.
The movie starts with the letters of the Lieutenant General being dug up on Iwo Jima in 2005. Were the letters actually buried and dug up later?
Well, there were some letters found there, but whether that was done in that exact same form, we're not sure. We're speculating because nobody really knows exactly how General Kuribayashi died. It was speculated that there was many stories. One that he died on the island with a PFC in attendance. And committed suicide, and another one that he just disappeared. But nobody really knows. The same with Berenishi, who was an Olympic equestrian champion in 1932 at the Los Angeles, at the Olympics in Los Angeles. And he, nobody knows quite how he died, except that it was speculated, and there has been stories written that he was blinded and he stayed behind in a cave by himself.
My guest is Clint Eastwood. His new film, Letters from Iwo Jima, opens this weekend. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Clint Eastwood, and we're talking about his new movie, Letters from Iwo Jima, which is a companion to his film that was released in 2005, Flags of Our Fathers. Flags tells about the Battle of Iwo Jima from the American point of view, the battle and its aftermath. And Letters from Iwo Jima is about the Japanese soldiers in the battle. The film opens with shots of Iwo Jima today. Can you describe what it looks like now and what it felt like to be there, knowing the casualties in that battle?
Yeah, it is. It's like visiting any battlefield, going to the Utah or Omaha Beach and Normandy or any of those battles here, and you can almost feel the activity there. The first time you walk out on Green Beach, which the Americans named it Green Beach, which is right at the foot of Suribachi, and you walk out there in that deep black sand, and you start thinking about all of the, and looking out there and visualizing an armada coming in of American ships, it's quite overwhelming. And you think of all the Marine Corps personnel who suffered casualties on that island. It's an overwhelming experience. And then the first, we did that the first trip over there, and then later on when you go over there to film, and then you film down in the caves where and where the hospitals were all built underground in caves, and where the places where the troops resided, you wonder how the hell they did it, because it's amazing. The island is a lot of geothermal activity, so these caves are they're tremendously hot, and so there's just very humid things. In fact, you go into them now, and they don't recommend you stay in there more than 15 or 20 minutes. But these people had to stay in there for days at a time.
The cinematography is really beautiful. Sounds like the wrong word to use, because we're talking about war here. It's not like it's pretty, but the mood, the tone of it, just seems so right. A lot of the sequences are shot in something very close to black and white. I think that the color is so subdued, it looks almost black and white, although it's very blue-gray more than it is black-white sometimes. But the explosions are in full color. Would you talk a little bit about, like, figuring out what look you wanted the film to have and how you went about getting it?
Well, the film was shot in color, but I sort of desaturated. We desaturated it down to the point where it didn't look comfortable color. We certainly didn't want the picture to have a technicolor in the old fashioned sense, Dorothy and Toto in The Wizard of Oz or something. But we wanted to desaturate it down to what it looked almost close to black and white. I mean, the colors were very subdued, and of course explosions are a little brighter because they're explosions. So it was just a question of choices that we all made to have it have that look, which gave it the non-comfortable feeling of war.
Because the movie is from a Japanese point of view, the actors in it are largely Japanese. I mean, there are some Americans portrayed as well. And the movie is shot in Japanese. The characters speak Japanese, and it's subtitled. So I don't know, were most of the actors who you cast English-speaking as well? Were you able to communicate to them in English?
Yeah, there was several of them spoke English, but we also had interpreters along for the actors that didn't, and the majority of them did not speak English that well, because we brought most of the actors from. There was a few from Los Angeles and New York, but most of them were brought over from Tokyo, and we had interpreters, we're all, you know, emotions are emotions in all languages, and so it wasn't a hard thing to do. But I didn't feel that the picture should be told in English, have Japanese people speaking English, because that would definitely feel more movie like to me. They should be speaking Japanese, except in the scenes where English is the predominant language being used.
Did you meet survivors of the Battle of Iwo Jima from each side?
Yes, I didn't. Not from the Japanese side so much. There's not too many of them. Out of the 22,000 men that were stationed on the island, they only 1,000 survived, and we're not sure how many of them were combat folks or whether they were Korean. Conscripted labor, but there were a few, very few, and we didn't get to talk to too many of them. Though I've read articles by some of them that are all quite good, but American survivors, I talked to quite a few of them.
Is there an image that really helped guide you in making Flags of Our Fathers from those conversations you had with survivors?
Well, yeah, there is. There's one image that is kind of common, is that most of them that were in combat there, they just never really spoke about it too much. They would get together and maybe have Marine Corps celebrations or Marine Corps organizations, but they wouldn't really get into they didn't, there's not the gung-ho-ness that you'd think there would be. There was just, it was a tremendous battle. It was intended to be a 3 or 4 day affair, lasted over a month, and tremendous. They were pinned down a good portion of the way. When you see an awful lot of your friends wounded and killed, it's not something you forget easily.
Have you gotten any reaction yet from Japanese viewers to Letters from Iwo Jima?
Yeah, well, the film's been out there for 4 weeks now, and it's running very, very well, doing tremendous business in Japan. So the Japanese viewers and Japanese reviewers have been very kind to the film, and I think they like it from an entertainment standpoint, but they're liking it historically as well. I think the younger generation is getting a lot of answers to curiosity about the that battle and what the wartime conditions were for the Japanese soldiers and civilians.
What about Flags of Our Fathers? Did that show in Japan?
Yeah, that showed in Japan too. That ran first, and that did well there too. But Letters, of course, is doing tremendously well there.
Clint Eastwood will be back in the second half of the show. His new movie, Letters from Iwo Jima, opens this weekend. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Ovid's The Metamorphoses, in stores and online at bn.com. And from 20th Century Fox Home Entertainment, presenting The Illusionist, starring Edward Norton, Paul Giamatti, and Jessica Biel, now on DVD. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new 12-DVD set of remastered Rodgers and Hammerstein musicals. And we talk more with Clint Eastwood. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Clint Eastwood. His new film, Letters from Iwo Jima, tells the story of one of the bloodiest battles of World War II from the perspective of Japanese soldiers. It's a companion to Eastwood's 2006 film, Flags of Our Fathers, which described the battle from the American perspective and told the story behind the famous photo of five Marines planting the American flag on Iwo Jima. Flags of Our Fathers takes a very heroic image, the picture of the soldiers planting the American flag at Iwo Jima, and looks at what really happened and how much more ambiguous the story is when you know what really happened. The photo was actually staged after the original flag was given to a congressman, if I remember correctly, who asked for it.
Yeah, I think the Secretary of Navy asked for it.
Is that it? Okay.
That's as much as we can get on it.
And then the men in the photo, at least in the telling of the story in the movie, feel like frauds because the photo was staged, and they it's seen as this great heroic moment, but they don't feel like it was a heroic moment. What spoke to you about this story?
Well, the picture wasn't staged, and that's what makes it so great, is the picture is just people matter-of-factly trying to put up a flag. But it was a second flag, because they had put up one before that was a smaller one, and they decided to exchange, much like you laid out here. But it was different. They just didn't think too much about it, three out of the six men who raised the flag in the famous photograph were killed within a week or so of that incident, and including even one of the cameramen, the movie cameraman. And so they didn't feel heroic when they just felt they were just doing a job. And all of a sudden they're brought back, and they're being called the heroes, and they're being treated like tremendous stars, and being romanced by politicians and society in general to go out on these bond tours. And so it's a little tough for them to accept that. It's a big thing to lump on the people who are 19 or 20 years old and all of a sudden be in that kind of commotion.
Did you see a lot of World War II films in the 40s and 50s? And did they have an impact on you?
Yeah, I saw a lot of them when I was growing up. But yeah, they did have an impact on me. They were exciting as a kid to watch war movies. You're always rooting for somebody, mainly our side. And the enemy was always portrayed as villainous, and our guys were always portrayed as heroic. But those days are gone. I mean, that era was more black and white with it all, and that isn't the way war is to somebody else. So it's fun to look at it from different perspectives, but those wars were those war pictures were mostly propagandistic. They were selling America as great, and that's where the audience was, and that's where it would always be.
Your view of violence in movies has really changed over the years, and some of your early films were very violent, particularly the Sergio Leone westerns like The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. I mean, those films almost take a certain pleasure in violence, in film violence. And, you know, the last few movies that you've made are just, some of them are so much about the costs of violence, whether it's, you know, in war or on the street. Was there a turning point in your life where you started to rethink rethink film violence and what you wanted to do with it? I mean, I think of the turning point in your movies as maybe being Pale Rider and Unforgiven. But in terms of like what you wanted to do with your gifts when portraying violence on screen.
Yeah, I think I've been interested in that probably. I think it's just a natural maturing of life, is at some point you start thinking about things a little different, but differently. But that's part of the growing up process. And I always figured myself, even though I'm in a senior status right now, I still consider myself a person who's growing up. So you're always changing thinking of things from a different perspective, and you're looking for stories that think of things from a different perspective. Unforgiven, you mentioned, was a man who was haunted by violence, and so we got into that thing where how it affects you personally and what it does to your soul. And I think now in present times we're looking at World War II, which is easy to look at, but what that has done, what that did to the souls of those men when they came back, and how some of them had a hard time adjusting to civilian life after being asked as very young men at an impressionable age to go off and get involved with violent activity.
I'd like to just ask you about your movie Million Dollar Baby. in which you played a boxing coach at a neighborhood gym who reluctantly takes on a woman boxer and ends up caring for her like a daughter. And as everybody knows, some people on the right accused that film of advocating assisted suicide. And I felt that anybody who had actually seen the film would find it hard to think of the movie as like promoting assisted suicide, considering the incredible cost, without getting deep into the plot, the incredible cost that it has for the person who helps. I'm wondering what it was like, what the experience was like for you to find a film being, I think, very misinterpreted and used for political effect.
You hit on the most important activity when you say have seen the picture. If you have seen the picture, you look at it a lot differently. I certainly don't advocate assisted suicide. I don't believe in suicide, or assisting. But I can see where a person might get to that. Imaginatively wise, you can see how people might get to that position. And this was an extreme case. But that doesn't mean we were advocating going out and saying, "Okay, this should go on all the time." You're always telling extreme cases, but that's what you do when you do a play or a movie. You're always telling some sort of a story with extreme dynamics to it, and you take the story and you take a person who's lost a relationship with his daughter and has no. And feels terrible about it, and then he finds a relationship with a sort of a surrogate daughter, and then all of a sudden a tragedy happens, and how does he deal with it? And he doesn't deal with it, and we don't portray the character I was portraying. We don't portray him as a person who goes off and lives happily ever after. It's his soul is ripped for the rest of his life, but that's the drama of it all, and you're telling an extreme situation.
What did it say to you that your movie was used in the way that it was to make points that you didn't think it even made? You know, that it became this kind of talking point.
Well, people interpret things the way they want to interpret them, and that's you can't do anything about that. The majority of the people got the program, and the majority of the people, whether you're rightist or leftist, I don't think anybody feels that different. The intelligent audience about it in the long run.
My guest is Clint Eastwood. His new film, Letters from Iwo Jima, opens this weekend. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Clint Eastwood. Early in his career, he starred in a trilogy of iconic westerns, For a Fistful of Dollars, For a Few Dollars More, and The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Each of those Italian films had scores by Ennio Morricone. Morricone also scored several films Eastwood directed. Morricone is now considered one of the most important and influential movie composers of our time. He'll get an honorary Academy Award this year. Next month, he'll make his first American concert appearance. He'll conduct his music at Radio City Music Hall and will also give a private concert at the UN. Before we ask Eastwood about Morricone, here's Morricone's theme for The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Thank you.
your movies with Sergio Leone had scores by Ennio Morricone. And at what point did his music enter into the process for you? Like, take The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, for instance. At what point did you hear that really incredible theme that he'd written? Was all of your work done already by the time you heard it?
Well, the first time I heard it was on Fistful of Dollars, which I had gone off and made during a hiatus of Rawhide. And I did the picture in Europe and then came back. And then they were asking me to come back and do a sequel the following year. And I said, well, how about sending me the first one? Let me see what that looks like. Let's see what we've got, because I've been reading about how it's doing well on the foreign box office and everything, but I had no idea how it looked. And I came in, and all of a sudden this score comes on, and I thought, wow, this score is really unusual. And unusual is the thing I would say about Ennio Morricone, is that and I don't know whether it's him or a combination of Sergio Leone, but Sergio was always very interested in music, and he was always interested in the framing of sound effects and music in films. And and Morricone was part of all those three films, A Good, Bad, and Ugly, and Feed All Is More. And then we used Morricone on Two Meals for Sister Sarah and In the Line of Fire. So over the years, we've spent a lot of time with Morricone scores.
Did looking at yourself on screen with his music behind you give you a sense that you didn't have before of how music could change the impact that an image had on the viewer?
Yes, absolutely. The Leone pictures were very, very operatic, and Morricone could go flat out on those with great trumpet solos and all kinds of different sounds and stuff. And he was very, very clever, very innovative for that particular time, especially. And now he's been imitated by many people since then.
If this is too personal, just let me know. You're in your mid-70s now, and obviously still directing great movies. How does getting older compare to what you expected, say, being in your mid-70s would be like?
Well, it's a lot better than I thought it would be. I think that getting older is great if you're constantly learning something, you know, providing you have good health and all the things that everybody wishes for. But you know more. You can look at things from more perspectives, and you've seen more in life. And if you enjoy it properly, it can be a nice experience. A lot of people joke about it. Henry Bumstead, who was an associate of mine who just recently passed away in his 90s, he used to always say, "Oh, to be 80 again." You know, so it's all a point of it. All depends on where you're looking from. If you're 40, you say, "Oh, 30 wouldn't be bad." Or if you're 80, 70 looks pretty good. But it's a great learning experience at life, and if you keep it as a learning experience, it's always fun.
You have such an iconic face because of the movies that you've been in. I think all of us, as we get older, we look in the mirror and study how our face is changing with age. And, you know, some people decide, oh, well, it's changing. I don't want it to change, so I'll get cosmetic surgery or something. And if you don't, you examine your face changing and you make of it what you will. You know, it's interesting, or you regret it, or, you know, whatever. What's it been like for you, with such an iconic face, to watch your face change with age? And to watch it on the large screen as well as in the mirror, yeah.
I don't think one pays that much attention, because it's a gradual process, and you're this way, and you look this way at this point of life, you're this way, you feel this way at this point of life, whatever it is, and you go on and you enjoy the going on. If you sit there and worry about it and say, well, gee, I'll get cosmetic surgery and I'll try to look like I did when I was 28. That ain't going to happen. All it's going to do is make you look like you have a vanity of problem with it, and it's not going to be pleasant when people come up to you and say, "Didn't you used to be so and so?" And so it's kind of it would be kind of an embarrassing moment. So I think people have to just accept things the way they are, and move on, and say that was another phase. Your 30s were one phase, your 40s were one phase, and just keep on going.
Is cosmetic surgery a problem for you as a director, because so many actors have had or are having it done, and you can tell looking at them on a big screen?
It is a problem, because if you're casting a person in a film and you say, okay, I'd like to cast so and so in part, say, well, now you have to say, well, could you bring him in? Before, you could say, well, I know his or her work, because I've seen him in many pictures, and so I don't have to see them. I know how good they are. But now you'd say, maybe, well, let me see how they are today, because, like you say, you're insinuating here, they may not look the same. They come in and they say, Jesus, they're all cosmetized, if that's a word, And there you go. That's not the look I was expecting. That's not what was in my imagination when I thought of casting that person.
Are you already working on another movie?
No, not right at the present time. I'm trying to abstain.
Take a little rest.
Exactly.
You probably never expected these two movies to come out as quickly, you know, as close to each other as they did.
Well, they were both sort of distant companions of one another, so it was a way of coming out. Yeah.
Well, Clint Eastwood, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Clint Eastwood directed the new film Letters from Iwo Jima. It opens this weekend. Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz reviews a DVD collection of Rodgers and Hammerstein musicals. This is Fresh Air. Among the most popular film musicals of the 1950s and 60s were the ones based on the most popular Broadway shows of the 1940s and 50s, the long-running musicals by Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has some reservations about these musicals, but he says that there are some features on a new 12-disc DVD set that are more than worth the price of admission.
Richard Rodgers and his first lyricist partner, Lawrence Hart, created some of the best musical comedies in the history of Broadway. But when Rodgers was offered the opportunity to do a musical version of a sentimental folk comedy called Green Grow the Lilacs, Hart wasn't interested. So Rodgers began his landmark collaboration with a new partner, Oscar Hammerstein II, already a Broadway legend in his own right. Originally called Away We Go, the musical version of Green Grow the Lilacs opened at the St. James Theater in New York with a new name, Oklahoma. The show was hailed for its innovations. It opened with a solo song, not a chorus of dancing girls. It had a dream ballet. It even had a threatened rape. And it had songs that furthered rather than interrupted the plot. Today, the cornball Americana of Oklahoma seems more like old-fashioned operetta, not nearly as sophisticated as the witty satires Rodgers wrote with Hart. But its tuneful songs became instant classics.
chicks and ducks and geese better scurry when I take you out in the Surrey. When I take you out in the Surrey with the fringe on top. Watch that fringe and see how it flutters when I drive them high-stepping strutters. Nosy pokes will peek through the shutters and their eyes will pop. The wheels are yellow, the upholstery's brown, the dashboard's genuine leather. With eyes and glass curtains, you can roll right down in case there's a change in the weather. Two bright side lights winking and blinking, ain't no finer rig I'm a-thinking. You can keep your rig if you're thinking that I'd care to swap for that shiny little Surrey with the fringe on the top.
Unforgettable tunes and a certain high-minded moralizing characterized the Rodgers and Hammerstein shows that followed. First was Carousel, with its touching love story moved from the Hungary of Ferenc Molnár's play Lilium to the coast of Maine. Then came a series of musical dramas that confront cross-cultural misunderstandings. The super-romantic wartime story, South Pacific. The King and I, about a 19th-century English schoolteacher who goes to Thailand. And Flower Drum Song, about the Americanization of Asian immigrants in San Francisco. Rodgers' last collaboration with Hammerstein was The Sound of Music. The most satisfying of all their films is probably The King and I, with excellent performances by Deborah Carr and Yul Brynner, who won his Oscar for recreating his Broadway role as the King of Siam.
When I was a boy, world was better spot. What was so was so, what was not. Now I am a man, world have changed a lot. Something's nearly so, others nearly not. There are times I almost think I am not sure of what I absolutely know. Very often find confusion in conclusion I concluded long ago. In my head are many facts that as a student I have studied to procure. In my head are many facts of which I wish I was more certain. I was sure. Is a puzzlement.
The bland acting in the lead roles of most of the other Rodgers and Hammerstein films, by newcomer Shirley Jones and such Hollywood types as Gordon McRae, Mitzi Gaynor, and Rossano Brazzi, underline the sugary wholesomeness of the shows themselves. But the secondary players come to the rescue. Rod Steiger as the menacing Judd, and seductively pouty Gloria Graham as Adu Annie, the girl who can't say no in Oklahoma. Juanita Hall hauntingly recreating her original role of Bloody Mary in South Pacific. But the real treasures in the Rodgers and Hammerstein set are the bonus materials. The Carousel DVDs include Fritz Lang's marvelous 1934 French version of Lilium, with Charles Boyer in one of his best performances as the tough guy carnival barker. And there are extraordinary clips from a landmark tribute to Rodgers and Hammerstein that was broadcast simultaneously on all the major television networks in 1954, which featured members of the original Broadway casts. In South Pacific, Mary Martin lifts you out of your seat because she's in love with a wonderful guy. And who wouldn't melt over Martin and the great operatic baritone Ezio Pinza singing Some Enchanted Evening?
Who can explain? Who can tell you why?
Who'll give you reasons wise men never try? Some enchanted evening, when you find your true love, when you feel her call you, across a crowded room,
and die to her charm, and make her your own. For all through your life you may dream all alone.
Once you have found him, never let him go.
Once you have found her, never let her go.
These Broadway stars have such personality and charm, such alertness to inflections, the way the music actually embodies what the words mean. They really make you care about what they're singing. Watching these clips, more than their generic Hollywood imitations, you really understand why these shows won America's heart.
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a new 12-disc box set of Rodgers and Hammerstein film musicals. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Ferriby is our administrative assistant. Ian Chillog directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of The Brotherhood of the Holy Shroud, a novel of suspense set in the time of the Templars by Spanish journalist Julia Navarro. From the Cato Charitable Foundation, advancing environmental values and saluting all those who work to sustain our world. And from 20th Century Fox Home Entertainment, presenting The Illusionist, starring Edward Norton, Paul Giamatti, and Jessica Biel, now on DVD. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Congressman Rahm Emanuel, the new chair of the Democratic Caucus, and Congressman Tom Cole, the new chair of the National Republican Congressional Committee, talk about the directions their parties are headed in and what they think of the president's plan for Iraq. Join us for the next Fresh Air.